Blog Talk Radio.
Once in a lifetime does a great author set the stage for a wonderful trip into the minds and lives of their characters. Yvonne Mason doesn't just write books, she crafts memorable experiences. Best-selling true crime fiction author Yvonne Mason will leave you on the edge of your seat and checking behind every corner for the weirdos that only real life can breed. Find her books on Amazon.com and make sure you check out such titles like Dreamcatcher, Failure Was Never an Option, The Pink Canary, and Silent Scream today.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, sirree, it is Thursday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. This is Off the Chain. I am your host, Yvonne Mason. And yes, once again, guilty. A piece of shameless promotion. And if you need a good ad for your book, for your music, for your artwork, for your business, for your passion, whatever you might need an ad for, get with my ad man, Christopher Dunham. He also has his own radio show, and he's always looking for sponsors, and he will do you up nicely. This man is very reasonable, and he, as you heard from the ad, he is absolutely excellent. So look him up on my Facebook page and get with him, and let him do an ad. I'm going to tell you, since the inception of this show and since I've been putting the ads that Chris has done on me for the, on this show, I can tell a difference in my book sales, because for you all that have been with me from the beginning and are hooked up with me on social network, y'all know that my goal is to have this show at 10,000 listeners by the end of the year. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as of this morning, we are 3,269 listeners away from the 10,000. Just on this show alone, we're almost to 2,600 listeners. This show's not even a year old. But when you add in all the podcasts that I upload this show to, which is SoundCloud, Spreaker, Mixcloud, Podcast.com, I can't remember all of them, but there's a half a dozen of them that I upload this show to once it goes into archives. This show is heard all over the world in little bitty countries I've never even heard of. So if you want exposure, I'm telling you, it costs you nothing except an hour of your time and to promote the show once we post it. And you get to use this show once it goes into archives and up into all the podcasts. It goes on iTunes, it goes on YouTube, it goes on Stitcher, it goes on TuneIn Radio, it goes on FM.com. Once this show goes out there and it goes into archives from here and it goes to all the podcasts, I tag you. I give you the link. You can use this show any way you want to promote yourself. It gets no better than that. Absolutely gets no better than that. Again, another piece of shameless promotion. Tonight, I have an opportunity to interview an author who, he and I are of like minds because we both love the same stuff. And I'm envious of him because he gets to play in his career. And unfortunately, I had to retire from mine because in South Florida, I can't hunt people without being a bail bondsman. I don't want that job. I just want to go get them and bring them back. But Lyle O'Connor, he left his childhood home in the Dalles in Oregon. And the Dalles now holds a very special place for me, which I'll tell you about in a little bit. And he decided that the Dalles was too small an area for him to expand his wings. So he takes off and joins the Air Force. And I want to thank him for that. Y'all all know how I love my veterans. They hold a very special place in my heart. Then he has an honorable discharge, and he enters the private security field. See, I told you I love this guy. He re-engaged his educational interest, earning a bachelor's degree and his niche in the behavior health field. His career in forensic psychiatrics, I can't talk tonight, and adolescent behavior health spanned more than 20 years. He retired in 2008 from state employment at Alaska Psychiatric Institute. He re-entered the workforce providing infrastructure security in the oil fields of Prudhoe Bay. And there in the frozen wastelands of the Arctic, he found solitude and time for reflection. His chosen profession offered a glimpse into the criminal mind and introduced him to the justice system, which has provided the basics for his vigilante crime writing. Lyle raises the level of his crime novels to new heights. And with that I say, welcome, 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 Lyle. I am so glad you're here.
Well, Yvonne, it's great to be here with you and to celebrate your 75th show, by the way.
Thank you for reminding me of that. I had forgotten that. We are 25 away from 100. Isn't that amazing? And it's all because of y'all.
Well, we're glad to be here with you.
And I know I said it in my intro, but I want to say it again. Thank you for your service, and thank your family for their sacrifice, because, you know, what people don't understand is, someone who is in the service, we love our veterans, and we thank them for their service, because we have a all-volunteer military now. We don't have the draft. But people tend to forget about the people that are left at home. You still with me?
I wanted to mention that I spent something I didn't use anywhere in my bio or anything, but I spent 18 years in a motorcycle club that was a veterans motorcycle club, and that's what we worked on primarily, was never having happen again what occurred to us. I tail-ended Vietnam and then a couple of years afterwards before I got out of the service. But, you know, the reception that the military received coming back from Vietnam was difficult. It made life difficult for a lot of our troops. And we, as members of a veterans motorcycle club, had determined that we would not let that happen again. And we did everything we could to make sure that veterans coming back from deployments overseas, you know, from Desert Storm to Iraq and Afghanistan, were welcomed back and knew that they were appreciated for their sacrifices that they made. So that helped me a great deal. I felt more made whole again, I guess. Maybe that's a word I want to use. You know, I just felt like we got something back. I'm not saying the wars were good or anything of that nature. I'm just saying that by welcoming these military troops back, I felt like we did something valuable for them.
And that is true, because I was part of that generation, and I saw what happened to our servicemen when they came back, and that was such an injustice to them, because they were only doing what they were ordered to do. And to be treated with such lack of respect and such disdain turned my stomach, because those were Americans, and they went and did the job that they were asked to do, and they did it. And like you said, those people, and I mean that in a kind and caring way, those servicemen and women deserved better when they came back.
Yes. It was. It also links to the very first story that I'd ever had printed in a periodical down south called De-Animalization, and it was a little bit of background, a short story of about 1,000 words is all they allowed. But de-animalization was a program that the Army used, and they put people through kind of a week-long intense training when they got back from the jungle. And they put them in this classroom and tried to take a year's worth of the jungle out of them in 1 week. And, of course,
impossible.
It miserably failed.
Of course it failed.
It was an effort.
That goes back to your behavior health field, you can't deprogram someone that has been programmed to go to the jungle and then survive in a jungle in a war that we had no idea how to fight, and then bring them home and say, okay, you get a week of deprogramming, and then see ya.
Yeah, exactly. Put them back on the street. Like that's going to make it work for them. And anyhow, with all those things, that was the very first article I had in print anywhere. And it was an exciting moment for me, obviously.
I would think so. And it was firsthand. It wasn't something that you just made up out of your head. You lived it. And I know that you lived it. And that is why any time that I see a veteran, especially one from the Vietnam era, and I know they're from that era, I want to just wrap my arms around them and tell them how much I appreciate what they did under circumstances that no one should have to work under or even fight under. I mean, the only rule was there were no rules. It's sort of like what we're doing now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had difficulty with the political side of war, and we became a football being kicked back and forth between political parties, and I don't like any of that. So I usually avoid talking about that part of it and focus on the troops themselves, you know, what we can do to help them, because we don't have a lot of control over this politics.
Well, and what was so irritating is it was never declared a war. It was always a police action. Really, we spend 10 years in Vietnam, and it's not a war. We lose thousands of men and women, and the rest of them come back tormented and broken, and it wasn't a war. What was it? Tea at the castle or something? A police action is when you go out and arrest somebody. I never understood that.
It was a terminology to get around what really was occurring. But,
exactly.
Anyhow, yeah, it's one of those things where, yeah.
Let's talk about Lyle. How in the world, let's talk about your history. We know you joined the Air Force, and we know you lived in the Dales, and you know why the Dales has become part of my soul now.
Certainly.
Explain to the people how small that city is and where it sits in relationship to the Columbia River.
Well, we sit right on the Columbia River. The Dalles is probably about 10,000 people. Maybe it was up to 12,000, 14,000 at different points. But somewhere in that vicinity, it's strung out along a very much of a curve, an elbow in the river there. We get a lot of wind, a lot of windsurfers, a lot of fun like that. But we're right on the Columbia River, and it's a beautiful river. And
There's
I was
a lot of
fishing
there, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Lewis and Clark expedition came there, and things of that nature, you know. I actually started life out until I was about 5 years old right next to the surgeons building there at Fort Dalles up on the hill in the Dalles. And so I used to, as a little fella, actually my sister, I think, took me over there and locked me up in their little prison cell, but and because she's going to listen to this, I want her to know that I haven't forgot. So anyhow, they used to have a lot of fun with me over there, but there's a surgeon's quarters, and that's what's left of the Fort Dalles there. So anyhow, I started out life there until I was five, and at 5 years old, my father bought a cattle ranch, and we went out there and bought our first cow and started in.
Wow.
Until I went into the military.
When you got out of the military and went into the private security field, what made you go? First of all, explain what the private security field is and what made you decide to enter that particular field.
Well, I started out in retail security, busting shoplifters and things of that nature for the first couple of years. Became a security manager at JCPenney's in Anchorage, Alaska. And then from there, I moved within Penny's chain once to Florida, to Sarasota, Florida. Well, I ended up in Clearwater, Florida, actually, at a store there because of some internal problems that they had. And then when that was done, I ended up moving back to Alaska and went to work for the state of Alaska and in the security treatment program that they had at the time, which was a lockup for people who were not guilty by reason of insanity and GIs. And it was fairly liberal at the time. People could get an NGI fairly easy through the court systems. and now Alaska is one of the toughest states to get an NGI in. So they've changed a great deal, and that change occurred because of one of the people at our hospital that had kicked a man to death about 9 years prior to him. They were trying to work him out, and they'd given him a job outside of the facility. Of course, the people who employed him weren't allowed to know because of confidentiality rules that he was a patient at the hospital because he's not guilty. He's, you know, he has no criminal record, so he's not guilty of any crimes, and so confidentiality laws are all in his favor. They actually fired him at work. We weren't aware of it because we have no communication with the employment at the time. When I say we, the hospital. And he had gone out. He had two guns that he had hidden on the hospital grounds. And he went to Russian Jack Park, which is maybe a mile and a half away from the hospital. And he ended up shooting four kids, killing four kids there.
Oh, no.
State legislators came back. Yeah, state legislators came back, and they rewrote the laws. And now it's one of the toughest states in the union here to get a not guilty by reason of insanity plea through. But, yeah, very sad, very sad situation.
And what people don't realize is not guilty by reason of insanity is not a defense. It is a state of mind, but it's not a defense that is, how can I explain it? We studied this in criminal justice. In other words, you can't say, well, use that as a defense to for reason of guilt or not guilt.
Yeah. Well, before the legislators rewrote the laws, in Alaska, it was, like I said, very liberal. Their goal was always for anybody who murdered anybody in some bizarre fashion or manner to try to get them into NGI and then get them worked back out into the community. Well, that worked in some cases, but it didn't work in all cases. And we had a number of actors that came back through the programs, until they ended up either getting medicated sufficiently or whatever happened with them, moved off to other states, things like that.
Sounds like Oregon. And Oregon is another state that has very liberal criminal justice laws. What made you go into the field that you are now in, forensic psychiatrics and adolescent behavior? To me, that is just an amazing field to go into, and it's mind-boggling at the same time because adolescents are a strange animal anyway, and when they hit puberty, turn into Jekyll and Hyde, then you have emotional and mental issues that are brought on by environment and I want to say exposure to drugs and other types of things that go on, and they see it. Maybe they are in a domestic abuse situation with their family, What in the world made you go into something like that?
Well, I started out on that security treatment program at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I worked out for, I don't know, maybe three, four years on that particular program, which was a lockup. I got a little, maybe bored with the program. I had opportunity to make a couple more bucks an hour, so I jumped ship and went over to the what then was called Charter North Hospitals, and it was they had adolescent units. They had a girls' unit and a boys' unit, both about 20 beds on either side, and I worked that. But I got a lot of great insight there because the adolescent boys would talk to me, and that was great because, you know, in a lot of the cases, probably I'm just going to throw out a number. It's not going to be accurate, but probably 50% of my boys had been sexually abused that was on my unit with me there. And a lot of these kids began to act out, negatively acting out, behaviors, running away from home, breaking and entering, things, various things. Troubles at school and things of that nature. So we had opportunity to try to rebuild trust with these kids. Very, very difficult to do because adults in their lives had betrayed them. And we were having to try to create some rapport with these kids to where they could trust us and not think we were out after something from them, things of that nature. So it was a great challenge to work this. And we were in a crisis scenario where we only had the kids for 30 days. Well, they would have to be in residential treatment or something. In most cases, they couldn't go back to the environment that they came out of because their homes were a shamble in most cases. And so I found it as a great challenge. I worked over there for 8 years with kids and had a great time working with them. You have some opportunities there that you don't have when you have adults. And so I worked with these guys and tried to, let me tell you this. A couple of cases that I saw, the kids were probably in their 20s when I met them again. And one of them was in the Army, was in the 2nd Infantry Division, was up here in Alaska visiting his mom, things like that. I felt very proud that I helped him. You know, I mean, I was one of many that helped him, but I helped him, and he came up and told me that, and that's why I'm saying this.
Wow.
And you don't get to see that very often. And it's not like mechanics where you fix something, you know, and you hope it stays fixed for a while. This situation here with humans is incredibly different. And anyhow, I was just really happy to be able to see these guys out making it, doing a good job, not in trouble. You know, things of that nature.
Yeah, because sometimes children get broken. They stay broken because they're so emotionally, mentally, and physically damaged. You can't, it triggers another part of their brain that you can't ever write again.
Yeah. You know, one of the other things we had, too, is as a problem with kids that were sexually molested by family members, which was the vast majority of the kids that were sexually molested. They were almost always family, but they commit suicide at a rate about 25% higher than the average. Well, first of all, it's already a high average with teenagers for suicide, but it may be either the leading or the second, you know, highest reason for death with teens. But these kids that have been sexually molested or physically beaten just horribly bad and things of that nature, they have a much higher rate of suicide. So, you know, you have a little bit of a window to work in, and that's all. And,
yeah, because they carry around the guilt that's not theirs.
Oh,
it belongs to the person that perpetrated the crime on them, but they carry that guilt around feeling that they have done something wrong because they were convinced that this is all on you. It's our dirty little secret, or it's your fault that I beat you half to death, and it's not their fault.
No, not at all. And you also have this kind of continuous problem that goes on as these kids grow into adulthood and they do the same thing. You know,
uh-huh.
you get this kind of a deal that happens, and you have to break that cycle somehow. So, you know, you have to get into it and break the cycle. Because we found out a lot of times, you know, when it was Uncle George or stepfather, this or that, you know, is involved, that they also have history in the same thing. And
it's generational. Yep, it's generational.
It is.
And if you don't break the cycle, it will continue for generation after generation after generation. Well, I also found out something else about you that probably helped you in your field, and that you do martial arts.
I did. Yeah, that was some years ago. I say that because one day when I was about 40-some years old, I got thrown into the mat by a white belt, and it hurt. Anyhow, that began to be kind of a turning point in my life. I had been in martial arts for, I suppose, pretty close to 20 years, and worked a couple of three or four different systems. You know, one of the great things about martial arts is you don't have to use it to be violent. It gives you confidence, and not only confidence, it allows you to be face to face with somebody, like on these units, the security units and stuff, and be more calm than somebody who's maybe turned their body sideways and is starting to shake a little bit and stuff of that nature. As the adrenaline's pumping, I don't get the adrenaline pump. You know, it just doesn't hit me like that. And then if something does happen, and occasionally we have physical interventions versus verbal. If you had to do physical interventions, you do so in a way to protect that patient, you know, so they're not injured. And where if you find people who are unskilled, you know, they sometimes go into it like it's a personal fight, you know, and it's not a personal fight. It's an intervention. And it was hard to get that through guys' heads that saw it as personal. You know, it was never personal. Probably when I was 55 and my last maybe week or two on a lockup unit, which was where I worked the last 6 years or so, on the forensic unit there, you know, I got punched in the face. And I blocked a lot of it, you know, but I did get tagged, and it didn't create hostility in me or anything, because your mind is, you know, already prepared for this is a potential. You know, the guy was completely naked, walking down the hallway, sweaty. Okay, he's got a problem going on, and we tried to direct him into what's called a quiet room out there, and where we can de-escalate the situation. Well, as soon as I stepped out the door, I just took my glasses off, stepped out the door, and he swung and hit me. And but it's you know, martial arts helps you not to react that way in the sense of violence. You know, this is a job, and you do the job the way it's supposed to be done. And my concern and my care was for that patient. I'm going to have to control him, obviously, but I'm not going to try to hurt him to do that. I'm just going to try to get some management of his aggressive behaviors.
Until he can come back to himself and say, oh, I screwed up.
That or he's going to go into four-point restraints. We had humane, what they call humane, four-point restraints. And if the doctor orders it, medication will get on board to help him get control of themselves.
Well, brings me to this question. With everything that you have in your history, I mean, the tail end of Vietnam, private security, forensic psychiatric, adolescent behavior, what in the world made you go into writing, which this is a mother load of material for a writer, but what drove you to take that dream and run with it?
Well, are you familiar with the term called journaling?
Yes.
Yeah, it's for my personal therapy.
I understand that. I do that myself.
Yeah. To some degree, I suppose I wanted to work through some of these scenarios and how it would be differently. Of course, now realize my difference is I have a vigilante as a protagonist in my novels. So some things, you know, some things some of these situations he would work out differently than I would personally. But I do have a tendency to agree with him on a lot of them, if that's fair to say.
What made you use a vigilante as your protagonist?
Let's see. It's probably me. I write it in first person for a reason. You know, and like I say, it's to some degree, I saw a lot of stuff that I don't feel that the victims are being represented well in our courts. I don't feel the victims. Well, in some cases, let me say it this way. In some cases where the courts have been involved, they've gone very liberal in a situation, and many of these people were victims to the point of death, and then, you know, and very brutal, violent deaths. I'm talking about the population that I dealt with specifically.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and then you find out that the worst thing is going to happen to them is they're going to live a cozy life, you know, in prison, maybe for the rest of their lives. And that's only a maybe. Well, I guess maybe I think differently about some of those things. You know, I don't oppose a death penalty. I think a death penalty, if it's used properly, is a valuable tool to the court systems. And now people are going to disagree with that. And I know that. I've read the disagreements many times. But I'm a proponent of the death penalty. So.
Well, I am too, and I say that from a strictly clinical point of view because you've known me long enough, you know what my degree is in. It's in criminal justice.
Uh-huh.
And I have seen the evil that men do, and I've seen the intended and unintended consequences of the evil that men do. And granted, yes, in times past, there were people on death row that shouldn't have been there. I give them that. But our forensics has come so far that even if you don't have a smoking gun, you can pretty much nail the perpetrator without it because of the forensics.
Yeah, technology has been our friend. There's no doubt about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
To become more sure of situations that have transpired. The DNA on people, things of that nature. You know,
and then when we coddle them and try to recidivize them because they just made a mistake, they really didn't mean it, and then we turn them loose to perpetrate more crimes, that's when you've got to hold, and I'm like you, I'd probably be a vigilante too. We have to hold that particular state's criminal justice system liable because they falsely thought that you can rehab a murderer or a rapist or a serial killer.
Yeah, I've never seen that. But it hasn't been my experience. The only safety net is if they stay locked up forever. But on my Facebook page, my author's page, I run some different headlines each day for people who follow it. And one of those is judicial failure. And I have one of those every day. There's a judicial failure somewhere. A guy that was convicted to death and 36 years ago, I believe it was. Well, they're going to let him out now. This is a guy who should have at least been commuted to life, you know. But instead, they're going to let him out because 36 years ago, they don't even have the people to retry him now. And he was supposed to have been dead a long time ago. And now since they can't retry the case, you know, a judge has decided that they have sufficient reason to retry it. They don't have the people. So they did a plea deal for time served and put it out.
Oh,
so,
that's just wrong.
You know, and you've got a family now that's been re-victimized. To me, that's what happens.
And therein lies the problem of what you said, it's when a crime is committed, when a capital crime is committed, it's not just the victim who is hurt or murdered or disassembled. It is the family of that victim that keeps, as you say, getting re-victimized because the judicial system can't get its head out of its ass.
Well, Florida certainly has its share of it, because I follow some of that down there with
the
200 guys now that are on death row that aren't going to be on death row, and you know, and it's just, to me, it's just legal shenanigans. You know, it doesn't amount to what they did at all, and it has to do with what the judge told the jury or something, you know. And
technicalities.
When you're letting people out of jail or commuting their death sentences or whatever you're doing. And, you know, something that I read just yesterday or the day before, that a recent study shows most of the people on death row don't want to die. How about that?
Gee,
that's
they
why they
tried
to do the appeals. That's
but,
right.
But they didn't mind taking someone else's life. Now, okay, an accidental death, like vehicular homicide, if you're not drunk or on drugs, it was just poor judgment. Okay, I get that. But to deliberately plan and plot, and these people that commit murder, they know what the results of their actions could possibly, let's say Joe Blow goes into the local convenience store and he's got a gun and the clerk gets nervous and Joe Blow shoots him. Joe Blow knows in the back of his mind, if he walks into a convenience store, that the odds of him shooting that clerk are 100-1.
Yeah. Yep. The you know, there's never seemingly any concern about the victim's families, things of that nature.
No.
Occasionally a judge will reference it, but it doesn't end up showing much in their punitive stage of their case, and that bothers me some. There's a fella that was a professor at a university, I believe it's Connecticut, and I'm shooting in the dark a little bit on that, but it's up there in that area. Anyhow, he bludgeoned his wife to death because she wanted a divorce and she was going to take half his millions. So he beats her to death. And then lies, runs, does everything he does. And he's getting out now. He served 10 years. And I say, are you kidding me? 10 years? When your reason was greed? You know?
He should have been shot on sight. Forget trial. Just take him straight to the chair or the firing squad. It's like my criminal justice professor told me. He said, sadly, Yvonne, the Constitution protects the just and the unjust. And I said, you're right, it does. So hence we have 7 appeals for somebody that's sitting on death row, which can take 20 years or more. And like you said, by then most of the witnesses are dead, so you have nobody that can testify in court. And unless you've got a court that's willing to take prior testimony from the transcripts, which they may or may not do, because the defense will argue, well, how do we know it's not hearsay? And that blows that idea. They're going to get out.
Yeah. Well, and let me make mention of my novels just for a minute.
That was where I was going. We're going back full circle to your novels. Get out of my head, Lyle.
I'm kind of an activist, but the way that I do it is through the crime fiction and vigilante writing, is to raise awareness of human trafficking. Each of my novels, because there's so many avenues of human trafficking, from labor to the most prominent one, of course, is sex trafficking. A lot of the child pornography is human trafficking in particular, even forced marriages, you know, in some of the other places that end up with that problem, more so, is still human trafficking. But organs, how about body parts? You know, there is a human trafficking aspect to body parts. So my guy, my protagonist, is involved in raising awareness to people by utilizing fiction stories And hopefully some of these folks will come to my Facebook page where I put all real stories that support everything I'm writing, essentially. And with human trafficking, it's now the third largest criminal enterprise or activity in the world. There's more money. It's almost better than drugs, you know, and less than 1% of those people are ever rescued. So it's a pretty sure thing. And my biggest concern now, one of the areas that I'm turning towards, is the buyers of sex, buyers of labor, buyers of whatever. The buyers, from my studies anyhow, the buyers aren't getting much penalty. You know, I mean, almost all the penalty phase goes towards who's ever pimping or doing whatever, of the trafficking. But if the market wasn't there, you wouldn't have so much of it.
That's true.
Because a lot of these strictly profit. You know, it's a for-profit thing. And so anyhow, I'd like to see the justice system work a little harder at I know they don't want to do this, but penalizing Joe Blow, you know, the regular guys doing the buying, because they are the problem. They create the market for it.
And they are the, as we would say in retail, they're the end user. So you get rid of the end user, then you don't have the market. Then your little middleman that goes out here that winds up in prison for 30 years doesn't wind up in prison for 30 years for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So my purpose of my novels are basically for awareness. Raise awareness to the issues. I try to channel people to my Facebook page, which I utilize a lot for the purpose of substantiating a lot of the same things that I write about, showing you that these things are real. They're happening frequently. And third largest criminal activity.
I have your synopsis for due process. And if it's all right with you, I want to read it and the synopsis for the second in that you put out, the Lawless Measures Vigilante,
sure.
The Fight Continues, because these are amazing synopses. Sadly, I haven't read them yet, but, you're going to be one of my new favorite writers. Ladies and gentlemen, you're welcome. The first book that Lyle put out in... No, you cannot go now and order it. You have to wait till after the show. I see y'all trying to go. I've got to go look. No, you got to wait. I can see through my computer, ladies. Due Process by Lyle O'Connor. Enter the realm of a serial killer. Share his thoughts, his emotions, his pain, and his need to assassinate. Walter, an ordinary factory worker, obsessing over the mistreatment of victims by the courts, becomes a vigilante for justice. Appalled by adjudicators coddling criminals under the guise of civil rights, Walter factors himself in as a lethal consequence for depraved individuals walking out of court with a slap on the wrist as punishment for heinous crimes. He has no particular skill sets qualifying him to fight crime. He relies on cunning, isolation, and his hunting and tracking skills to take down targets and bring about his form of justice. A kaleidoscope of dreams and apparitions thrust Walter into a nightmarish world where the lines of good and evil are dissembled. When applying justice, he finds right and wrong interchangeable. Body count is his only measure of success. Now, the second book, Stop, Y'all Cannot Go. No, you can't go check out his book now. You got to wait till after the show. Lawless Measure Vigilante, The Fight Continues. Book 2. Walter Elroy Go, crime fighter and vigilante for justice, takes on Palantini project aimed at eliminating the mafia sex trafficking of underage girls along the New York and Canadian border. The operation morphs into an all-out war when the Palatani's lead asset for the project, an assassin, goes missing and is presumed murdered by the Abadanza crime family. Walter splits with the Palatini knighthood when he's ordered by Society Palatini Grandmaster Maximilian Carnage to abandon Anna and to tie off the operation. Walter takes his one-man war to the mob in methods they understand. Body count climbs as he abducts and interrogates mobsters mafia style. The war heats up when two Palatini knights join Walter in his lust for blood. Together, they set out to revenge Anna's death and to annihilate the Toronto-based crime family engaged in the sex trade involving kidnapped underage girls. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you all are thriller, suspense, crime-fighting readers, I highly recommend these books. Now, you have another one coming out, if memory serves me correctly, called Blood Appeal. Is that correct?
It came out in April. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it did come out already. It did come out already.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it continues Walter's quest. Would that be a fair assumption?
Yeah, well, the situation here is more of a road trip. And, going to Toronto, obviously, was a road trip, too, since this guy comes out of Portland, Oregon. That's his base. And in Blood Appeal, he takes a little time off after the Toronto scenario resolved. And he spends a little time down in the lower part of Missouri, at Table Rock Lake at a little place called Shell Knob, Missouri. And he's just spinning his wheels a little bit, he's been there maybe 3 months or so, and a young lady is found dead. Well, in a place like Shell Knob, it's not common, and like your big metro areas. And I'm the newest, as first person I rode it in, Walter was the newest person in town. So all the eyes are kind of cast on him as the potential. And he has to take matters into his own hands. And he is able to do a road trip to Alaska and back to Missouri to reconcile the situation. So it's a shoot and run scenario a little bit, but same thing. These are kids that were being kidnapped from Alaska tribes in particular. These guys were a private militia that was doing this action, and they were kidnapping young girls and raping, killing them, those kind of things. Because there's a big businessman involved that wanted to get into some areas in which the tribe owned and wouldn't allow him to. So he was putting a lot of pressure on the tribe. So it's a little bit of a conspiracy type, type story. I do have another one, though, that will be coming out also in that series, and that's called Blue Edge. And it will involve a retired police officer and my vigilante. And even though they don't work together, they end up working together. So
when will this one be out?
We're on a rewrite situation right now, and it kind of depends on how quick I can get the rewrite done, and then it'll go out to some beta readers, and and then we'll do some editing, and it'll go to the publisher, and they'll edit. I don't know.
I'm asking because I want to launch that fourth book on this show.
Okay.
I know we talked earlier that you're going to be in God's half acre for about 6 weeks, freezing your little tutu off. And
yeah.
So I want to bring you back because you will gain a following on this show. And we can launch the book on the show. So stay in contact with me and let's get some dates and figure out when this thing might get ready to launch, and we'll do the next show for that book. I'm thinking May or June, easy.
I'm going with 2017. Wow.
I think it'll happen
like October or November.
No.
I don't know. The process with a publisher takes a while, and of course I work a full time job. So we work 12 to 14 hour days when we're working up on the slope, the North Slope of Alaska, and you know I'm in infrastructure security up there. I'm also an EMT up there. I drive the ambulance, those type of things. So I stay kind of busy sometimes, and sometimes I get a little tuckered out, you know. I'll be sitting in front of my computer 30 minutes after I get off the shift, and I'll be asleep. So I don't know if that's ever happened to you before, but it does happen to me sometimes.
I wake up and I go, did I just write that? How long ago has that been? Well, all right, let's do it this way. We're going to bring you back regardless of whether or not the book's done, but I still want to launch the book on the show. So we'll bring you back in May or June. You're going to keep up. You're going to let me know what your work schedule is, and I'm going to leave some dates open for you in May or June and bring you back.
Okay.
So we didn't even get into infrastructure security. EMT, I didn't even know about that. I mean, you've got so much material that you can use in your books. I'm envious.
Well, I'm pretty sure that I can keep somebody alive for a couple of weeks if I needed to with an IV, as an EMT. Oh, no, I mean Walter, not me, Walter.
See, you don't even know. You've become your character.
I love him.
I've already fallen in love with him, and I haven't even met him yet. Where can you be found? We need to let these folks know where they can find you. So after the show is over, folks, you can't go now. You've got to stay and listen to the end of the show. After the show is over, they can go and they can friend you on Facebook. They can like your fan page. Where all can you be found?
Well, Amazon, of course. All my books are for sale there, and I have an author's page on Amazon. But the book's also available not just in print, but they're also available digital. So that's available. It's also available with Barnes & Noble, same way, both the print and digital, and iTunes for digital. And it's Kobo and all the rest of these that I'm not real familiar with even. So the books are available as far as the books go on those things. But I prefer people just contact me on Facebook. I utilize it more than I do my blog. In all actuality, the blog that I've got on there right now, I'm going to redo. And I'm going to try to progress the blog to something better than it is right now. So Facebook is where I do most of my activity. Of course, you can message me there. I will hook up. It's Lyle O'Connor Writes is the author's page, and then or Lyle O'Connor. And you can hook me up either way there. And I love to talk to people, so that's not going to be a problem. And
well,
I even will discuss difference of opinions.
There you go. Yeah, we do that quite often. And that brings me to one more question because the hour is gone. I mean, we're like 6 minutes before we sign. I told you we'd go fast. So,
I was really worried about what we were going to talk about for an hour. So that was.
See? Remember I said the show's not scripted because I never know what path we're going to wind up taking. And we've talked about a lot and haven't covered half of the things, so that we'll save some of that for next time. But in about 2 minutes, will you tell the folks out there, because I believe in dreamers, and if a dreamer comes to you and says, Lyle, I admire you, I have a dream, but what would you tell them?
Pursue. I wouldn't let anything, if I have a dream, whether or not I think I can do it or any of those kind of things, you have to put that can't idea out of your mind, and you've got to step forward and try and work at it. When you have a dream, sometimes you have to work at that dream. A lot of people just think, well, you know, all you do is just sit down and write or whatever, or artistry work or whatever, you know, it's just going to flow. Well, it does flow. It may not flow right. But you can edit a page, but you can't edit nothing. So you have to get down and do it. And if you don't do it right, that's fine. Because there's, I mean, I don't even know what right is. I write the way I like to write. I don't write by anybody's formula. And I hope I write things that people like to read. You know, that's what I want to hear back, is feedback. But basically, if we're talking about writing or something of that nature, because people have come to me before and said, you know, I'd like to write a book. I have a situation that happened to me, blah, blah, blah. Pursue it. Pursue it. Get it down on paper. You'd be surprised what you'll start to remember. If it's a nonfiction, if it's fiction, work your story. Continue to work your story because you'll learn a lot more about it as you do it.
And that is very true.
Yeah, if you never take a step forward, it won't happen.
And we go back to what you talked about earlier, and that is journaling. I am a firm believer. I have 20 million, and that's exaggerated, but I have lots of journals around here. When the kids say, what can we get you for Christmas? Give me a journal. Because not only do I write about things in my life, but I write down story ideas.
Sure. Well, like I'm sure you do this. Excuse me. At night when you lay down, that's when all the good ideas come to you. And then you got to get up and, you know, you got to write them down.
Yeah.
Or you have your microphone next to, you know, on your phone there ready to go, and you're just talking to your dragon or whatever the case might be. I have notes written down on all sorts of stuff, but I also have a notepad on my phone. So a lot of times it'll be maybe one word or maybe six words, and I'll write it into my notepad and come back and see if it still resonates later as to what I was thinking, you know. Excuse me. And a lot of times I improve my stories by that one word sometimes. You know, puts it on a course that's a little better. And so it doesn't all come in one shot when I sit down. It's piecemealed together incredibly. And you never throw anything away. You put it in a file back and back and save it for later because you don't know when you're going to come back to it. It may not be that novel, maybe the next one or two down the road, whatever the case might be.
But it'll be there.
That's right. And you just don't want to dump everything out. That's the last thing you want to do.
So, ladies and gentlemen, before we run out of time, and we're going too quickly here, it always does this to me. I hate when that happens. Tomorrow night, Friday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, author Glenn Stripling will be here. You don't want to miss this because he writes some great, interesting sci-fi stuff. And Saturday night, we have a author named Anne-Marie Martin. Don't want to miss her, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Lyle, I want to thank you for being here. Thank you. I am so humbled. Thank you for spending an hour with me. You're one busy man. I appreciate you, and I am so grateful for you.
Well, I want to thank you for allowing me to be with you on your 75th show.
That is a milestone, is it not? It's a wonderful thing.
It is.
So,
absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, understand this. If you have a dream, live it, because our society is made up of dreamers, and without dreamers, we have no environment, we have no society, we have no inventions, we have no new books, we have no new music, we have no new passion. Accept yourself where you are in life, flaws and all, it doesn't matter. We're not perfect. When you accept yourself, you will like yourself. When you like yourself, you will love yourself. When you love yourself, you will learn how to love others unconditionally. Do not be afraid to fail. Because when you take that first step, you're not failing, you have succeeded. Not to have done anything is to have failed. So for the dreamers out there, dream big or go home. We only live once. Until tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, this is Off the Chain with Yvonne Mason and my guest, Lyle O'Connor, and we say good night. Okay, the show has ended, but that's okay.
Okay.
like I said, we have the little after thing here. But remember when I said that when the show goes into archives, I will download it and put it on podcast?
Right.
Well, once it archives, I'm gonna put the link up on my page, and I will tag you in it. And then probably be tomorrow before I get the podcast up. But when I put the podcast up, I will also put the link on my page, and I will tag you in it. Put that everywhere, Lyle, because this has been an incredible show, and I absolutely had so much fun, and I am so grateful, and I thank you so, so much. And next time, we're going to talk about EMT and infrastructure security and all the good stuff we didn't get to tonight, and find out what's happening with Walter.
Yeah, that should be fun. No, I had a great
time. Yeah, I'm excited.
I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did it. I was never apprehensive about doing it, though. I mean, I guess I believe that if something avails itself as an opportunity, you should take it, and especially in the business of being an author. It's a crowded field out there. So it's any opportunities I have, I would go forward with it. And even if I don't think I'm a good speaker or anything like that, and of course I'm not, but I'm not a public speaker. Let's put it that way. But I still feel comfortable.
Just me and you and 6,500 of our closest friends.
Sure, and that didn't bother me any because I don't know most of them.
But just think, they could be there's 6,500 potential readers that we just approached.
Absolutely. I mentioned this to a content editor of mine who lives in Florida, Pensacola, Florida, and he's been with me since the very first volume that I put out. And I mentioned to him I was going to do a radio show down there, and I said, I don't know how big radio shows get, I have no idea what a person would expect. And he said, it doesn't matter. What matters is doing the show. And of course I was already going to do it. So it didn't matter as far as that goes. But I kind of believe like he does, that it's best to like I said, take the opportunities as they avail themselves. A lot of people fight hard to try to find an opportunity, so I'm sure there's lots of people lined up trying to get on your show.
Well, We have bookings through the middle of April, and every day I get one or two people saying, so-and-so recommended me, what are the chances of getting on your show? And I immediately write them back and say, how does April so-and-so or May so-and-so sound? And they write me back, and they go, really?
Yes. I'm a member of the Authors Mastermind group up here in Alaska. And as people who basically deal in marketing, not so much the craft of writing, I was a member of the 49 Writers up here, which was primarily a craft-type outfit membership. But just recently, since I moved to Missouri, just recently I joined the Jefferson City, which is the state capital there. I joined their critique group, and I've never been in a critique group before, so this is kind of fun. And also, I just made application to the Missouri Writers Guild. You got to be accepted there and everything, on your merits or whatever. But so I'm getting a chance to get out a little bit, now that I'm not living in Alaska all the time. So I also get to Florida every now and then. So,
well, if you get to Florida, just come by. If you get down on the east side, down in South Florida, my neck of the woods, just tap on the door and say, I come to see you, and I'll say, come on in, let's sit down and talk.
I'll do that. Maybe sometime, I don't know about a show, but maybe sometime if I'm in the area and you want to do a show too, you can do it live right there together in person.
Oh, I have all the setup for that, honey. We can do this.
Well, I know I've heard your lady that's, I guess your publisher maybe, that gets on the show with you sometimes. I've listened to some of the shows where she's been on it and stuff, so I assume you had it kind of set up that way.
Yeah, it's she calls in, but since then I have set up a studio in what used to be my office. So now I have two offices, and one of them is my studio. The studio was still in the process of being put together. I have equipment laying around I got to hook up. And Blog Talk Radio and I are fighting about doing Direct Connect, but we're still working on it. But when I get it all set up, I will be able to have three other people in studio with me while I do a show.
That would be fun.
My goal is to make this thing so popular and so out there that indie authors that are coming up, plus my indie authors that I have now, have a platform. Because like I said, people follow this show and they follow certain guests on this show, and that's what I try to do. That's why I want to keep bringing my guests back, because as I bring my guests back, their following will listen to the show, and that keeps them up on everything that the guest is getting ready to do, getting ready to release. Then they will tell people who will tell people, and see how this thing just grows. This entire show, thanks to people like you, has taken on its own life form. I started this show on July the 29th. This is January the 19th. It's not even a year old. And it's taken on its own life form because the response has been so marvelous, and people have all said yes. And I am so grateful for that, because you guys are getting so successful. Things are happening, and I expect things to start happening with you after this show.
That would be great. I just think, I got to go up and work up on the pipeline. But like I said, there's less than 3 years left, and I'll be 66, and we'll call it quits, you know, on that. But I'm 63 now, so I'm cruising in on that last retirement. I retired from the state of Alaska, too, so I have a pension from the state. But we don't, in the state of Alaska, you don't pay into Social Security, so I had to work 10 years to get my 40 quarters in for a second retirement. So
oh, my goodness.
That's kind of what I'm doing.
We're going to keep you warm through the radio and keep your books selling. So look at January. Look at May. Tell me what you got open in May. Send me a note. Tell me what day you want in May, and it's yours.
Okay. All right. And I've got more things we can talk about. I just haven't brought them up yet. But.
See? There you go. And we'll keep doing this, and then when you get ready to launch Blue Edge, which I can't wait for it to come out, we'll launch it on the show. We'll have a big launch party on the show and maybe do a giveaway or something if somebody will call in, because by then you should have a following. We got all kinds of things we can do.
Yeah, that'd be great. My book, the first one, Due Process, right now on a digital, is on digital for free downloads. So the publisher put them out, you know.
Sweet.
Since I have a series. Yeah, since I have a series, the publisher put it out. And so we're giving away the first book right now as far as digital e-book.
And that's something that we didn't tell on the live show. So when people listen to it in archives, they get that little tidbit.
Yep. Great.
All right, my dear. Well, send me some dates in May. I will close the show out. I will get it in archives. I will load it up. I will load the link up on Facebook, tag you in it, and then tomorrow I'll upload it on all the podcasts and tag you in it. I mean, we're talking iTunes, YouTube, Spreaker, Stitcher, Mixcloud, SoundCloud, Podcast.com, TuneIn Radio, FM.com. Now, Stitcher is heard on Sirius Radio.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting everywhere.
Absolutely. Well, I read a book here the other day that makes mention, and this is a marketing book, makes mention that YouTube and Facebook are probably the two best sources to put your time and energy into. So the podcast that you're talking about, you know, goes into YouTube. And that's good. That's great.
Yep. It's on my channel. When I put it up on Spreaker, Spreaker sends it over to TuneIn Radio, YouTube, and FM.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then Blog Talk Radio sends it to iTunes and Stitcher.
Okay.
So
There's a lot out there that I've never heard of. if you don't work
this,
in that field of it, you don't know.
Well, once this thing goes up, give it a couple of days, and then go in and Google Lyle O'Connor podcast or Lyle O'Connor blog talk radio or Lyle O'Connor off the chain or Lyle O'Connor interview, and you're going to see all these places where you can be heard.
Okay, great.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much. Send me those dates, and let's keep rocking.
Sounds good. I'll keep in contact with you on Facebook, if nothing else.
All right, dear. Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you, too. I very much appreciate the opportunities here.
All right, honey. Good night.
Talk later. Good night.